Punjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Punjabi Hari. Jaya Gopi Chanda Vaya Haba, Jaya Giri Dara Dari, Jaya Giri Dara Dari. Jaya Gopi Chanda Vallabha, Jaya Giri Dara Dari, Jaya Giri Dara Dari. Yashoda Nandana Gajajana Ranjana, Yashoda Nandana Gajajana Ranjana, Yamuna Tira Banachari, Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Punjabi Hari. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna,
Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama.
Sarasati Devi, Gurahani, Kacharne, Nirvishesha, Shunyavadi, Ashokadi, Shatarne, Jai Shri Krishna, Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Gadadara, Shri Vasadi, Gaura Bhaktavinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Thank you for allowing me to serve the Srimad Bhagavatam today. We are on third canto, seventh chapter, shloka number 10. The title of the chapter is Further Inquiries by Vidura. Yad artena vinamusya, humsa atma viparyaha. Pratiyata upadrashtu, swashiras chedanadikaha, yad artena vinamusha, humsa atma vipayaha, pratiyata upadrashtu, Sashiras Chedanadikaha. Please chant.
Yarakena Vinamusya.
Yarakena Vinamusya.
Umsa Amiparyaya.
Umsa Amiparyaya.
Patiyata Upadrastu.
Patiyata Upadrastu.
Sashiras Chedanadikaha.
Sashiras Chedanadikaha.
Synonyms, yet, thus, artena, a purpose or meaning, vina, without, amusha, of such a one, humsha, of the living entity, atma viparyaha, upset about self-identification, pratiyate, so appear, Upadrashtu, of the superficial onlooker, Swashira, own head, Chedana Adhika, cutting off. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. So here, Maitreya is answering Vidura's inquiries. He started the answering, I believe, one shloka ago. The living entity is in distress regarding his self-identity. He has no factual background, like a man who dreams that he sees his head cut off. Let's do it one more time with repetition. The living entity is in distress.
The living entity is in distress.
Regarding his self-identity.
Regarding his self-identity.
He has no factual background.
Like a man who dreams.
That he sees his head cut off. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. A teacher in school once threatened his pupil that he would cut off the pupil's head and hang it on the wall so that the child could see how his head had been cut off. The child became frightened and stopped his mischief. Similarly, the miseries of the pure soul and the disruption of his self-identification are managed by the external energy of the Lord, which controls those mischievous living entities who want to go against the will of the Lord. Actually, there is no bondage or misery for the living entity, nor does he ever lose his pure knowledge. In his pure consciousness, when he thinks a little seriously about his position, he can understand that he is eternally subordinate to the mercy of the Supreme, and that his attempt to become one with the Supreme Lord is a false illusion. Life after life, the living entity falsely tries to lord it over material nature and become the lord of the material world, but there is no tangible result. At last, when frustrated, he gives up his material activities and tries to become one with the Lord and speculate with much jugglier words, but without success. These activities are performed under the dictation of the illusory energy. The experience is compared to the experience of one's having his head cut off in a dream. The man whose head has been cut off also sees that his head has been cut off. If a person's head is severed, he loses his power to see. Therefore, if a man sees that his head has been cut off, it means that he thinks like that in a hallucination. Did you all get that part? So the metaphor Prabhupada is using is if a man is seeing himself, his head being cut off. So it's not really possible to see your head being cut off. So he's comparing this involvement of the entity in material nature. He's making the comparison there, the metaphor that similarly his involvement in nescience in material nature is like that hallucination. Just as seeing your head being cut off is a hallucination, it's not possible. Similarly, a living entity is eternally subordinate to the Supreme Lord, and he has this knowledge with him, but artificially he thinks that he is God himself, and that although he is God, he has lost his knowledge due to Maya. This conception has no meaning, just as there is no meaning to seeing one's head being cut off. This is the process by which knowledge is covered. And because this artificial rebellious condition of the living entity gives him all troubles, it is to be understood that he should take to his normal life as a devotee of the Lord and be relieved from the misconception of being God. So the jiva's rebellious condition here is being called artificial, and it gives him all troubles. And then to regain his normal life, he should become a devotee of the Lord. That's a nice metaphor Prabhupada's using here. Normal life is to become a devotee of the Lord, and the rebellious condition is something artificial, like a hallucination of seeing one's head being cut off. The so-called liberation of thinking oneself God is that last reaction of avidya, by which the living entity is entrapped. So that one starts to think, actually, I'm God. It's the Mayavadi teachings, they actually have that teaching. You're God, right now you're being covered by Maya, so you don't understand that, but once you've uncovered the Maya, you realize that actually you're God. And you can give yourself a name like Vishnu or Krishna. The conclusion is that a living entity deprived of eternal transcendental service to the Lord becomes illusioned in many ways. Even in his conditional life, he is the eternal servant of the Lord. His servitude under the spell of illusory Maya is also a manifestation of his eternal condition of service. Because he has rebelled against the service of the Lord, he is therefore put in the service of Maya. He is still serving, but in a perverted manner. When he wants to get out of service under material bondage, he next desires to become one with the Lord. So those who have a little more knowledge about the misery of the material world, or this isn't the all-in-all being a material existence, jnanis, they get some knowledge. And then the last snare of Maya is to decide that I'm God. This is another illusion. The best course, therefore, is to surrender unto the Lord and thus get rid of the illusory Maya for good, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 7:14. We can say it together if you like. Daivihi asha guna mayi mama maya duratyaya mame vaye prapadyante mame tam tarantite. The only way you can get out of this illusion is by surrender, and a liberated person or Krishna himself has to pull you out. That's the only way to get out of this hallucination, this illusion of Maya, this nescience. Chakalpa Tribyascha, Kripa Sintubi Eva Cha, Katitana Pavanabu, Vaishnavi Gilmanaha. So in the shloka, Maitreya Prabhu says, the living entity is in distress regarding his self-identity. He has no factual background. So I think we can all relate to this. We all sort of found ourselves in our current lives. We woke up one day, we found ourselves in this life, certain nationality, certain circumstance, certain parent, and we think that this is the all-in-all. So this is a jiva's covering of avidya, or ignorance. And because we identify with this life and this body and mind as being the all-in-all, Narada Muni says to Vyasadeva that this is the root cause of all despondency, identifying the body and mind as the self. I don't know if any of you have thought about, I'm sure most of you have since you're here. At some point you woke up in your life and you thought, how can this be it? You know, how can this be? I'll just live out the rest of my life and then I'll have to die? Like, how is that? That can be it. Did anyone, obviously everyone here, have that similar sort of realization? And I know that ever since I was very small, I always had this idea, like, how can it be that everyone here, like, we're all gonna die one day? It can't be right. There's something, you know, wrong with this. Ever since I was very small, I had this idea, and then I thought, like, well, why should I go to school? Why should I do anything if we're all just gonna, like, die one day? So I don't know if anyone else can identify. Did you want to share something?
Oh, no, I used to think, okay, I'm going to school. Go on to school. And then I'm going to get married, and then I'm going to have kids, and they're going to go to school, and they're going to get married, and they're going to have kids, and just a cycle that's meaningless.
And it's like, then we're all going to die at one point. And
yeah.
It's like, but so many people out there, they do take this as the all-in-all. You know, they don't. I've talked to, you know, met people, relatives who are like, don't you, you know, and I asked them, but don't you, like, isn't it problematic that we're all going to die one day? Doesn't that bother you? And they're like, no, it doesn't bother me. Like, that's just going to happen one day. Like, that's how it is. So we can see that that's the covering of avidya, of ignorance. And for us, it has been thinned out a little bit, either through the practice of devotional service or through lifetimes of yoga practice. And we sort of, it thins out and we start to question, how can this be the all in all? So Narada Muni to Vyasadeva tells him this is the root cause of all despondency, is when we identify with this idea that this is the all-in-all. And Prabhupada says in the purport, in the material world, everyone is engrossed with the idea of identifying the body or the mind with the self. As such, all knowledge disseminated in the material world is related either with the body or with the mind, and that is the root cause of all despondencies. This is not always detected, even though one may be the greatest erudite scholar in materialistic knowledge. We know that our true position is that we are eternally part and parcels of the Supreme Lord, and that due to conditioned life only, that we have this idea of struggle. And Bhagavad Gita 15:7, the living entities in this conditioned world are my eternal fragmental parts. Due to conditioned life, they are struggling very hard with the six senses, which include the mind. So we're internally connected to Krishna, but due to this covering of Maya, due to being immersed in nescience and conditional life, we are struggling with the senses, which include the mind. So again, it's that illusion, it's that hallucination. The living entity is the fragmental part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, eternally. The Vishnu Tattva is the personal expansion, and the living entities are the separated expansions. The separated expansions, living entities, are eternally servitors. As fragmental parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord, living entities also have fragmental portions of his qualities, of which independence is one. Every living entity as an individual soul has his personal individuality and a minute form of independence. By misuse of that independence, one becomes a conditioned soul. And by proper use of independence, he's always liberated. In his liberated state, he's freed from this material condition, and he is under the engagement of transcendental service unto the Lord. In his conditioned life, he's dominated by the material modes of nature, and he forgets the transcendental service of the Lord. As a result, he has to struggle very hard to maintain his existence in the material world. And from the purport above, and because of this artificial rebellious condition of the living entity, it gives him all troubles. And it is to be understood that he should take to his normal life as a devotee of the Lord and be relieved from the misconception of being God. So how does this pure soul become entangled in this nescience? And Vidura Prabhu was inquiring earlier in the chapter about this, he calls it this crisis and distress about his identity. Vidura says to Maitreya, the pure soul is pure consciousness and is never out of consciousness, either due to circumstances, time, situations, dreams, or other causes. How then does he become engaged in nescience? Right? If he's, the pure soul is always pure, and how does he become engaged in this nescience? And then Vidura says, my mind is greatly illusioned by distress of this nescience. I can relate to that. My mind is greatly illusioned by the distress of this nescience. Please, Maitreya, answer me. How did this come about? How did the pure soul become engaged in this nescience? The pure soul becomes engaged in nescience, being influenced by the avidya potency of the Lord, because he has unlawful desires to lord it over and play the part of the predominator instead of the predominated. The living entity cannot be forgetful of his real identity unless influenced by the avidya potency. And that is also a potency of the Lord. The jiva potency, or the kshatriya shakti of the Lord, has the tendency to be overpowered by the external potency, avidya, karma, sangya. And in this way, he is placed in the awkward circumstances of material existence. So because the pure soul, the jiva, has unlawful desires to lord it over, he has a tendency to become taken over by the avidya potency, because that's not his actual position. The miseries of the pure soul and the disruption of the self-identification are managed by the external energy of the Lord, which controls those mischievous living entities who want to go against the will of the Lord. So this avidya potency is a management tool, if you will, of the Lord to control those jivas who want to go against their correct position of being subordinate to the Lord or being a servitor. They have this idea that they want some other program, so then this avidya potency is there to manage them and to manage his desires to try to do that, and that's the avidya potency of the Lord. A living entity's unlawful desire to become one with the Lord is in every respect the root cause of the entire material manifestation. So this Prabhupada says this unlawful desire of the living entity is the root cause of the entire material manifestation. So go ahead, we'll make this world for you. You can go ahead and you can try to be the predominator instead of the predominated. And under the spell of this external energy of the Lord, the conditioned soul suffers many unfortunate incidents in his life. The false attempt of the living entity to occupy the predominating post of the Lord is the cause of his material bondage. So his unlawful desire to occupy the predominating post is the cause of the jiva's material bondage. So this material world is created, it appears friendly and sort of like as a playhouse for the jiva. You wanna try this? Okay, go ahead. Here's a little playhouse where you can try it. But in reality, it's a correctional facility. It's a prison house. And he has to be gradually, over many lifetimes, corrected in this false idea. When he realizes that he cannot enjoy as a predominator. So another interesting word used by Prabhupada, it's actually in this chapter, he calls it also the kshatragya. The jiva is the kshatragya shakti of the Lord. And as we know from the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the kshatragya is the actual position of the living entity. That kshatra being like his field of activities or the body, and the gya being the knower of the body. So he's not actually the body, but he's the knower of the body. He's situated within the body, and the kshatra is his field of activities. And he acquires a certain body or a kshatra, a field of activities, according to his past karma. So he gets various grades of bodies according to his karma with which he can, you know, exercise within his field of activities, but he is actually the kshatragya, the knower inside of that field. He's not the actual field. So for the soul, for that knower, there's never birth and death, but for that field of activity, there is death. So that's our correct position, is that we're the knower of the body, we're not the body. And then within that field of activities, the kshatragya, there's actually two knowers. There's the individual jiva, and there's the omniscient knower, who is the Lord, the super soul. So he is omniscient. And the correct way for him to align himself within this field of activities is to turn himself to the omniscient knower and try to subordinate his will to the will of the one who knows, who is omniscient, and he knows all bodies, and he knows everything. And so that's the kshatragya. He's the kshatragya shakti of the Lord. And while the individual knower, the kshatragya, he comes under the influence of the three modes. The infallible knower, he is always transcendental, and he doesn't come under the mode, so it's an individual knower's advantage to take shelter of the transcendental knower. So what is the remedy for this distress of nescience. Can anyone take a guess? So what's the remedy for this nescience? Would anybody like to guess? Yes. So the remedy for curing this misconception of self-identity can be gradually diminished by the mercy of the Lord through the process of devotional service. And this application of devotional service invites pure knowledge, according to Prabhupada. The senses are the medium of material activities, and therefore the senses should be engaged in devotional service. And gradually, you can get out of this hallucination, this illusion of nescience, which brings him only troubles and miseries. The eternal relation of an individual soul with the Supreme Soul is constitutionally one of being the eternal servitor or the eternal master. The Lord has expanded himself as living beings in order to accept loving service from them, and this alone can satisfy both the Lord and the living entities. So to take the subordinate position and to offer loving service to the Lord, this alone can satisfy the Lord and the living entities when he comes into his normal condition. A living being's sustenance of existence is to coordinate his activities with his eternal relation with the Supreme Lord Krishna. So his sustenance of existence is to coordinate his activities with his eternal relation with Krishna. Krishna is the central pivot of living beings, and he is the all-attractive living entity or eternal form amongst all other living beings. Each and every living being has his eternal form in the spiritual existence, and Krishna is the eternal attraction for all of them. Krishna is the complete whole, and everything else is his part and parcel. The relation is one of servant and the served. It is transcendental and is completely distinct from our experience in material world. This relation of servant and the served is the most congenial form of intimacy. Okay, before I go on to the last section, did anybody want to add something to any of that? Did anybody want to share like how he became awakened to this idea? Maybe when they were young, Mother Agatmika shared of, this can be the all in all, we're all gonna die one day. And it may seem like not a big deal to us, but people out there, they don't think like that. They just think, yeah, I'm gonna die one day. It's like, I'm gonna think about that. I'm gonna cross that bridge when I get to it. Did anybody else wanna share how they, yes, did you raise your hand? You don't have to, I don't know. It's just happening.
I wasn't thinking, but
not how I got awakened, but I was remembering I was like 11 years old and my mother had bought some nice new clothes or something for me to attend something. And I refused to wear it because I would think, why do I have to wear this to impress somebody? I mean, I just couldn't understand the world. Like, why do we have to do something for somebody else? Because we're almost like, I'm not these clothes, you know, and why I have to put these clothes, these new things, and show that I'm good or whatever, you know.
Nice.
It wasn't an awakening, but just some thought.
Something like, I'm distinct from all that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else want to share?
Okay.
Yes.
In the course of your readings from the Shastra to support this point, I started to think, when we turned away from Krishna, we were wanting to imitate him, imitate God. And then it says that at one point, the last snare of Maya is to become God. Become one with God, or what? And then I thought, I guess that turning away is like a rebellious adolescent. And then that point of wanting to become one with God is like wanting to return into the womb, to our mother's womb, to be free from all this misery in the material world.
It's a nice distinction between those two. And I also had that inquiry, and since I did a little reading and meditation, and I also asked Nagaraj Prabhu that question in class. And I think that initial rebelliousness is more like, I don't want to serve. I don't want to take the position of service. It doesn't suit me. I'd rather just try to enjoy as the enjoyer. More like, I just want to enjoy. And then later on, like the last snare of Maya is actually thinking one is God is more like one gets some knowledge, like jnanis, you know, they acquire knowledge about some things, about suffering of the material world, about chakras and all that. And then with this knowledge, they think like, now I can try to become God. So it's like slightly distinct. You know, I have all this knowledge, I have some like, and I'm actually gonna give examples of some of these personalities, which they're very, very prominent. You may not think so, but they're very much out there. You know, they get some Shakti or some siddhis from their yoga practice or whatever, and they get material, you know, mode of goodness, and you know, they just get some like powers, and then they want to situate themselves as like, I am God, and I can like, and by their like charisma and by their siddhis, like they can acquire followers, and so that's the last snare of Maya. And it's like, I can acquire followers, I can, you know, I can be like the center, I can put myself as God. And it's very, very like easy to do so in today's world, especially with like Mayavad teachings, where they actually believe like, you know, I'm actually like, they give themselves names like Vishnu and Krishna. Like once I've like understood that I'm under illusion and I drop the illusion, I'm also like Vishnu and Krishna. You know, so it's very, very real, this snare of Maya. But even beyond like the yoga world, there's so many, you know, charismatic leaders out there who they can get followers and they have some knowledge and they have some potencies and they become godlike, you know, and that's the last snare of Maya, because that truly leads to their downfall, you know, because it becomes all about like Lord in the Shikshastakam, we sing like Nadanam Najanam Nasundarim. It becomes like all about that for people like that. So then they really truly fall into hell. So that's like the last snare of Maya. Once I get some knowledge and some siddhis and some followers, then I can become God. So I was actually gonna give some examples of that. we usually think of that as like yogis in India. You know, there's some like some yogi, he acquires some siddhis and now he calls himself like Mahavishnu, you know, and he gets followers and he gives them some like Shakti or whatever. So, you know, we have knowledge of that in India, but also in America, it's very, very, very prominent and real, and you may not think of it, even beyond like the whole Mayavadi yoga thing. Because in America, it's very easy to like start your own religion. It's very easy. Like in other countries, the government would like come down on you. It's like, you can't start your own religion, you know. But in America, you can start your own religion, and there's no one to regulate you, no one to stop you. So there's many, many cults that have been, you know, in America that wouldn't get away with it in other countries, and many charismatic leaders. And they become, you know, these godlike figures, and they just pave the road to hell as well as their followers.
Sachi has something to contribute.
Yes, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. When I was 6 or 5, I saw the sky in the night. Now, I like to see the sky every night, but one night I asked myself, who I am? What is this purpose in my life? What I have to do here? Now I'm 6 years, you don't ask anything else that for me. What a big question. So I was searching for that, and I find small books from, I don't remember which church or which philosophy, and I find that we eat to live or that we live to eat, something like that question. And that question was in my mind for a long time.
Nice, yes.
Then I find that we live to be happy. I try to be happy. But I think I never been happy like today with Krishna consciousness. No? So then I tried to be happy when I was a child without Krishna consciousness, and I think I never been happy like today, no, with knowledge. And I tried to serve anybody that made me happy, but no, like now, no, you know,
yes.
You serve Krishna, you serve devotees, but that make you happiness with knowledge. And anything's happened to me, I always, my answer is my karma. Also, this is the reaction of what, of that.
Thank you. That's nice. This realization as a child, looking up at the sky, which can make us feel very small and insignificant, looking up at the sky. But yes, you also had this realization very early on, must be from prior lives. And yes, we are all looking for that happiness. What is that happiness? Because that is our true position, as our in our true identities, is that we are, you know, we're made of Ananda. So we are all looking for that. And when these false leaders come along, you know, with these like promises, and they have some like charisma or some shakti, and they can like sort of give that happiness to people. And that's, you know, where some of these like false gurus and false leaders can try to give that happiness to people, or they give them like some healing or something. And so the person can easily say, yes, this is God. This, I choose to follow this. Thank you. Did anybody else want to share anything? Okay, so I was just gonna talk a little bit about some like godlike leaders in our current material world. So a big thing out there with these like godlike leaders, like false gurus today, is like a lot of them will say nowadays that they're like an alien. They're an alien, they've come from some higher planet, and they've come to like give humanity teachings, and they'll actually start to develop a following. You know, and they may be like intelligent, and they may have some like nice things to offer people, like some ideas about healing or some knowledge, and the people follow them, you know, like they're God. So this is a very predominating idea in today's world, is like they'll say that they come from another planet, because people are into like other planets and aliens, and they've come to give like teachings to humanity. So another prominent sort of false god that comes to my mind is like in the 1990s, there was this person called David Koresh, and he considered himself like another Jesus. He considered himself like a Messiah. And, you know, he knew the scriptures, like, he knew the Bible, like, inside and out, and people were like, and he could speak nicely, and he was charismatic, and the people just, like, you know, took to his teachings. So then, interestingly enough, he says that, you know, God, he went into meditation, and he told him that he has a message for them from God himself. He put himself like Jesus, like a Messiah figure, not quite God, but like I'm a Messiah. That's like a big thing with these like sort of false Christian leaders. They're like, I'm another Jesus, I'm a Messiah. And he said that like God told him that, you know, God was like the pure and the sinless Messiah. But he was to be like the sinful Messiah, and he was to experience all the sins of humanity, so that he knew like what the position of an ordinary person was. So God actually told him that he had to become like the sinful Messiah, and that he had his own like, you know, little like cult and like followers. It was ordained that he had to have like relations with like all the females there, even like the married ones, and all the men had to like be the husbands had to become like celibates, and only he was allowed to have relations with like all of them. So, you know, they followed him. So eventually that ended up, I don't know if you remember the story, ended up in like this like huge, the government like finally came down on them because they were like amassing weapons. They had like semi-automatic weapons and, you know, grenades and all kinds of things they were like amassing in their compound. And they were like, basically they were like preparing for the end of the world. And the government eventually came down on them, and there was like 50 some days of like a standoff with the government, and then they just like set themselves on fire. And so that was the end of that cult. It was like the Branch Davidians. It was in the 1990s. There was like No, in Waco, in Texas, not in Guyana. Guyana was another, that was the Kool-Aid. That was like when they all drank the Kool-Aid. I believe that was Guyana. Jim Jones was the man in Guyana, where they all drank the Kool-Aid. The guy in Waco was David Koresh, and he considered himself like a messiah. I was actually going to bring some visuals of that, but like, and I was going to talk about another person too, but I was like, maybe that's like too contaminating, but just so you can see like how he was charismatic and how they all just listened to him, and he knew the Bible inside and out. He could like quote anything, you know? And then, you know, I went into trance and God told me that I'm the sinful Messiah, and, you know, so that's how, and they all follow him, you know, and eventually they ended up, you know, they all died, just like the people in Guyana as well. We'll just finish with one more person. He was pretty big in the 80s. He was called Zen Master Rama. You know, and he was a white fellow. He was like a PhD, Dr. Frederick Lenz. And he took out this ad in the paper. He says like, I'm an enlightened master, and I'm searching for my followers from a prior life, so that we can all together finish our liberation. And, you know, he had some, I guess he was like meditating a lot, so he had some potency with meditation, and but there's also an aspect of like hypnotization. You can like hypnotize people. Like, he would encourage people when they would come to his like events, they had to like do this like gazing meditation where they would like gaze at him. And then apparently they would see like a golden light from gazing at him. And you know, I don't know if that was like somebody was playing with the lights or he actually had those cities, but in either case, you know, he wasn't like an enlightened master. They would see a golden light, and then I think he would hypnotize them, because some people afterwards were saying like, one day I just like woke up out of hypnosis and I realized like he's a fraud. So I think he would like hypnotize them. And then, you know, he was charismatic, he like had talks, he had books, he had like best-selling books, and one book he wrote was called like Snowboarding to Nirvana, just to give you an example of his books. It's called Snowboarding to Nirvana. But it was actually about like snowboarding, like it wasn't like a metaphor, we were all snowboarding to Nirvana, it was like about snowboarding and how that is like a spiritual practice. What's that?
You read that?
Zen Master Rama?
Did you read it?
I didn't read it, no. I just know he... And it was like, it was very popular. So he had some... The point is like he had something to offer the people, you know? So the clincher is... So they would do the gazing meditation. They would be taken with him. They would say, yes, I want to do this like program with you. I also want to become enlightened like you. They all believed he was enlightened. I also want to, you know, do this like meditation. But the clincher was like, they all had to become wealthy in order for them to give him like a lot of money. Like they had to at some point. They all had to like commit to a certain dollar amount that they were going to give to him each month. And basically said like, well, if you're not like growing in wealth, that means you're not growing in your enlightenment. So he like kind of combined those two, and then he encouraged people to like, computer coding was like really big in the 80s, like it was an emerging field, and so he was called like the computer guru, so he encouraged a lot of people to go into the computer coding industry, so they could like make a lot of money, so that they could like give the money to him, basically. So and that's just the tip of the iceberg. Like in America, I mean, there's like so many of those types of leaders and cults, and now it's like a lot of things are online. You know, influencers, and they're saying that they're an alien, they've come from another planet to give the teachings. So we can understand more and more the importance of the Bhagavatam and how important it is to take to this, you know, true process. And as we know in Kali Yuga, these like false religions, they become predominant, and the Vedic knowledge is sort of like, you know, thrown to the wayside. So this process which truly purifies the soul, and which is the true eternal dharma of the soul, we can understand how important it is, because people are, you know, thirsty for happiness, like Mother Sachi said, they're thirsty for happiness and they're looking for something, and so there's plenty of things out there that are there to like for them to take that up. So the Bhagavatam is the only, you know, true dharma and true religion that can give them any happiness. I'll finish there. Did anybody want to add anything? Grantarad Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.